Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, we continue looking at efforts to stem the overdose rate in Delaware, heading inside First State prisons to see what's being done there to help offenders with substance abuse disorder.
Ask that point-blank question, are you using? Because if you're not honest with us, you're going to get sick. And we want to be able to help you so you don't get sick.
Delaware Public Media's Nick Schlino examines the recently expanded medication-assisted treatment program in Delaware prisons. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn how President Trump's tariffs are affecting Delaware's manufacturing sector and hear about a local surgeon's effort to encourage bariatric surgery for severely obese children. Plus, a look at changes coming to the Hotel DuPont's famed Green Room. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Up first, we resume our coverage of new programs meant to reduce Delaware's overdose rate. A couple of weeks ago, we discussed ChristianaCare's Community SOS program, where the health system sends a medical team to the home of an overdose patient after that patient has been discharged from the hospital. The goal? Try to get that patient to enter into long-term care for their addiction. This week, we go inside Delaware's prison system, where the state recently rolled out an expanded program using medications like methadone to treat offenders with substance abuse disorder. Delaware Public Media's Nick Schlino reports.
Delaware's Department of Correction announced in June it is expanding medication-assisted treatment to all of its Level 5 facilities. The DOC previously only offered MAT to pregnant women and would also use medicine to assist offenders going through opioid withdrawal. But for the past few months now, methadone, buprenorphine, and Vivitrol have all been made available to inmates with substance abuse disorder throughout their stay in any Delaware state prison. This comes in response to the first state's rising overdose rate, which has reached 6th in the nation, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
I would expect that our program in the prisons will eventually catch up to where the rate is and start to bring the overdose death down.
That's Dr. Mark Richmond, Delaware's outgoing chief for the Bureau of Correctional Healthcare Services. He says since the expansion of the program, the number of inmates being treated with MAT has gone up from about 0.5% to a little more than 2% of the overall prison population. And he says the DOC is adding about 15 new patients each week. States like Rhode Island and Vermont have started similar programs with significant success. Statewide overdose rate in Rhode Island started to decline for the first time in years in 2017 after the start of the program. Richmond says it stands to reason Delaware will also be able to lower its rate as it increases the use of MAT in its prison system.
Rhode Island's about 15% of their average daily population, and Vermont is up to 50 to 60% of their average daily population of folks on MAT. So we have a way to go. I don't know where we're going to end up, but certainly we expect it to be more than where we are right now as we continue to identify people.
To make those identifications, Richmond says each offender receives a mental health screening upon admission to determine whether or not they are a candidate for medication-assisted treatment.
Ask that point-blank question, are you using? Because if you're not honest with us, you're going to get sick. And we want to be able to help you so you don't get sick.
Once a patient is identified as a candidate for MAT, they are asked if they would like to receive medication and which of the three options they are willing to continue to take. The MAT program is often coupled with mental health counseling as well. James Goddard is the health service administrator at Baylor Women's Prison in Newcastle. He says the program's rollout went smoothly as the prison was already offering MAT to pregnant women.
The only change was that we were providing it to everybody rather than just the pregnant offenders. We already had processes in place for the nurses on intake to refer the patients to a leadership so we could reach out to the clinic. So a little more work for us, but not an issue.
30 of the 350 inmates at Baylor are participating in the MAT program. Security staff is provided with a list of those patients and the times they are meant to receive treatment. Security then escorts the offenders from their cell to line up in front of a medical window and receive the medication. Here's Baylor's warden, Brian Emig.
It's a collaboration between medical and security to ensure that the offender has taken the medication. Oral medications, they ensure that a mouth check is done to include lifting the tongue. That way there's nothing that's being cheeked or moved throughout the facility and passed on to other offenders.
The Department of Correction is currently getting its methadone, Vivitrol, and Suboxone from its contracted medical provider Connections, but the state is seeking federal approval to designate its state prisons as medication dosing sites. That would allow the prisons to store the medications under lock and key on-site. Delaware is one of the few states that combine its jail and prison system. This means some offenders are admitted and released very quickly. James Goddard says having the medication on site would make the process more efficient and reduce waste.
There would be a lot less waste. As of now, the medication is brought from the off-site, and by the time they even get here, the patient could be released. So at that point, it's a waste of the medication.
And the time of release is the time of high risk for an overdose. Dr. Mark Richmond points to a recent state-run analysis of Delaware overdose deaths in 2017 that found 35% had interacted with the Department of Correction in the year prior to their death.
Unfortunately, a lot of people die of what are called hot shots back in the community, meaning that their body has become acclimated to being not on the opioids. Then they go back out to the community, use the same amount that they used before they came in, and overdose fairly quickly. So we obviously want to try to avoid that.
Delaware's statewide reentry team is in charge of connecting offenders to an MAT provider in the community and will even offer a ride to the provider when the offender is released. A Department of Correction spokesperson told Delaware Public Media the cost of administering MAT statewide in Level 5 prisons is currently being paid for from the DOC budget and from the prison medical provider Connections. The costs are expected to go up as more inmates take advantage of the program, and those costs will be reported to Delaware's General Assembly. Richmond says the cost is worth it.
By all accounts, it's been very successful. We get some anecdotal stories of former inmates saying, that basically it's saved their lives because instead of going back to the streets and looking for their first score, they're trying to stay healthy. So every life saved is worth it.
One offender recently released from Baylor and connected to a community MAT provider is Geraldine Holmes. Holmes is a single mother of two and works as an administrator in an HR department. She says she was hospitalized after suffering domestic abuse and received a prescription for opioids, which she began to abuse and became addicted.
Not with the right direction from the prescribing doctor, started to overabuse the prescription, which led to looking for opiates outside of what was prescribed to me.
Holmes was charged for felony possession of cocaine in 2017, which she says she was selling. She was receiving buprenorphine through Mid-Atlantic Behavioral Health when she was forced to spend 7 days at Baylor this September for violating probation. Holmes says she was able to continue treatment for her addiction while incarcerated.
To see people that come in withdrawing in there in the position that they're in and then able to get their maintenance while they're in there, it's a 100% 360 degree turn. And, it gives you a different aspect, a different outlook on life, hopefully, when returning back to the real world.
Holmes says Connection staff offered to help set up appointments with Mid-Atlantic Behavioral to resume her MAT in the community. She's now continuing her treatment and says she hopes to one day start a nonprofit to help felons like her find work. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Nick Schellino.
Thanks, Nick. And the Green continues in just a moment with a look at the impact President Trump's tariffs are having on the manufacturing sector in the first state. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The ripple effects of President Trump's trade war with China continue to find their way to the first state. Back in August, contributor Eileen Dalabrida outlined the tariffs' impact on the retail sector, including their potential to affect the upcoming holiday shopping season. We've also recently reported on the trouble they're causing some Delaware farmers. This week, contributor John Hurdle examines how first state manufacturers are feeling the pinch, and some efforts to mitigate those issues being led by Senator Tom Carper. You can find John's piece right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to discuss what he learned. Is there a sense of just how widespread the impact of these tariffs is in the first state, the range of businesses that are being affected in the manufacturing sector?
Well, there was a handful of businesses represented at a recent event put on by Senator Tom Carper to discuss this issue. Senator Carper's office has said that there are actually a lot more businesses that had signed up for this event, and they say that they've had many, many inquiries from the manufacturing community as to what's going on with these tariffs and whether the senator is in a position to help them do something about it. So the sense that I have on the basis of the manufacturers who attended the Carper event and the subsequent conversations that I've had with his office and with the Delaware State Chamber of Commerce is that, yes, that the effect is pretty widespread.
And while we heard earlier this year in some of our previous reporting that retailers can often pass along some of the costs they incur because of these tariffs, that is not necessarily the case for some of the manufacturers in the state, correct?
Well, that is correct, and all of the manufacturers that I spoke to at the Carper event and those that I've heard from subsequently, or at least the majority of them, I should say, have been unable to pass on the increased cost of these tariffs to their clients, and the reason is simply one of competition. They're all operating on pretty tight margins, and they say that if they increase their prices to their customers, then they're simply going to lose out to the competition.
And with that in mind, it would seem that then they kind of have to absorb these additional costs. One would think that at some point the rubber hits the road and maybe they've got to start cutting jobs or things like that. But it seems, at least for now, that we haven't seen any significant job losses locally because of these tariffs, right?
Well, that's right. The manufacturers that I spoke to said that none of them have been forced to actually lay off any workers yet. And of course, they were, understandably, I guess, they wouldn't talk about any job losses that might result in the future if these tariffs continue or if they increase. Given the assessment of the effect of these tariffs that they're having on these businesses, you have to ask whether at some point they might have to consider laying off people. And some of the language that they use to describe the extent or the impact, they use words like drastic and a major hit. So this is clearly causing some concern.
And along with that concern, one of the other issues you note is that this is all kind of creating an uncertainty around these businesses. Can you explain a little bit more, kind of beyond this job piece, how this creates uncertainty for these manufacturers and that affects how they operate?
I think the bottom line here is that businesses hate uncertainty. It makes it hard for them to budget. It's hard for them to plan on how much they're going to have to spend on raw materials and finished goods if those items are affected by the tariffs. They don't know how long these tariffs are going to last. They're going to they don't know whether there might be further increases in the pipeline. One of the manufacturers I spoke to, Eagle Group in Clayton, Delaware, they are a manufacturer of kitchen equipment for commercial kitchens, and they are affected by a 25% tariff. They're having to pay 25% more for finished items of kitchen equipment that they import from China. And one of their people said to me at Carper's meeting that they are kind of bracing for any possible increase in tariffs because they've already had one increase and they're thinking, well, maybe the 25% that they're currently paying is going to have to go up to 30%. And they're feeling very vulnerable to any unilateral action on the part of President Trump. And one of their folks said to me, well, you know, we don't know what's coming down the pike in terms of, you know, a presidential tweet. All of which is an example of the kinds of uncertainty that's causing quite a bit of concern out there.
Now, Senator Carper is co-sponsoring two pieces of legislation he says would help mitigate the issues manufacturers and others see from these tariffs. Let's take them one at a time. We'll start with the Trade Certainty Act of 2019. What does that do?
So that would prevent the president, whoever it might be, from using, there's another law called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, from using that law to unilaterally impose tariffs. And that law was designed to allow tariffs to be imposed on the basis of national security. And the proponents of this bill, who include Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, a Republican, say that the economic powers law was never intended to give the president a unilateral ability to set tariffs.
The other piece of legislation is the Reclaiming Congressional Trade Authorities Act of 2019. What's its purpose?
The purpose there is to reclaim or to return authority to Congress from the White House over trade actions, and specifically that would require Congress to approve tariffs that had been imposed on the basis of national security. Congress would have to approve those tariffs if they were within 120 days of their imposition. It would also require the U.S. Trade Representative to provide Congress with the goals and the strategy for any trade actions. It would also require the administration to assess the economic impact of those tariffs.
Talking to some of the manufacturers that you did, any sense of how they view this legislation and the kind of use of tariffs in general?
Well, I think they're broadly supportive. I mean, one of the manufacturers did say to me that he thought that he kind of agreed with the president to the extent that he viewed that, you know, China was had not been playing by the rules for a long time, but he didn't think that imposing trade sanctions, trade tariffs, was the way to do that. And so I think that that folks are pretty supportive of what Senator Karp is proposing here.
And how optimistic is the senator that there's support for this legislation that it could actually pass?
Well, I think it seems like on the basis of the number of co-sponsors for the bills, it's kind of early days yet. The Trade Certainty Act, he's got 8 co-sponsors currently. For the Reclaiming Authority Act, there's just 3. But Senator Carper's office points out that both of those bills are now out of their initial committee. But I think it's probably fair to say that it's a matter of wait and see as to how much congressional support these bills are going to get.
And finally, I guess the big question is, based on the folks that you talked to for this story, how worried are these businesses about their long-term prospects if something doesn't give soon in this trade war?
Judging by the kind of language that they used, as I mentioned before, you know, they're using words like drastic and major hit to describe the effect that these tariffs are having on their bottom line. It sounds like they are quite worried. Of course, the manufacturers, they're not disclosing specific information about the percentage hit that they're taking, but clearly they're worried about this, and that explains why they showed up to this meeting in the hope that the senator would give them some guidance on whether there was any more of this coming down the pike, or whether there was the prospect of any relief from this. And it's not clear to me that the senator was able to address those specific concerns, but of course, what he was able to do is to seek their support for these bills, which of course comes down to reasserting or ensuring that that Congress has more of a say over any imposition of trade tariffs going forward.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time on The Green this week. John's piece on the impact President Trump's tariffs are having on Delaware manufacturing is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And next on The Green, we hear from a first aid surgeon at the forefront of efforts to make bariatric surgery more accessible to children dealing with severe obesity. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Childhood obesity remains a stubborn issue across the United States, including the first state. The latest childhood obesity numbers from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation show Delaware's obesity rate for kids between 10 and 17 is at 15.1%, just a bit below the national average of 15.3%. And while various efforts to combat childhood obesity have helped those numbers drop slightly over the past few years, there is still a significant segment of kids, about 4.5 million, dealing with severe obesity. That's a body mass index of 35 or higher, or 120% of the 95th percentile for age and sex. One option in cases of severe obesity is bariatric surgery. And this week, the American Academy of Pediatrics released a new policy statement urging pediatricians, policymakers, medical centers, and insurers to improve children's access to metabolic and bariatric surgery. One co-author of that statement is at Nemours AI DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington. His name is Dr. Kirk Reichert. He's surgical director at the hospital's bariatric surgery program. And he joined me this week to talk about this new statement and the use of bariatric surgery for kids struggling with severe obesity. When we talk about bariatric surgery, what are we talking about?
So bariatric surgery describes a series of procedures that are designed to decrease food intake and decrease, in some cases, absorption of nutrients. And we're finding now, even more importantly, actually changing some of the local hormonal activities in the GI tract. And so there are several operations that have been proposed and have been performed to achieve one or more of those goals.
Are there one or two that are more common procedures that are done at this point?
So kind of the classic gold standard is the gastric bypass, which I think most people equate with bariatric surgery, mm-hmm. and that's done laparoscopically. But not only does it substantially reduce the size of the stomach, but also bypasses part of the intestine, which A, adds to the complexity and possible risks of the procedure, and B, adds to the potential for long-term nutritional consequences. But I think that would probably be considered classically the most common one. Now the most common operation, certainly in adolescents and also really I think in adults now, is the sleeve gastrectomy, which is a more recent procedure that was actually developed as a part of a much more complicated procedure. But this procedure itself involves taking a specially designed stapling device and removing most, say, 80 to 85% of the stomach, leaving a tube of stomach between, you know, the esophagus, the swallowing tube, and the intestines. But it does not involve rearranging any intestines, so there's no risk of malabsorption, which is where you get really severe diarrhea after eating sugar, and there's less risk of serious nutritional consequences. And so that's probably the most commonly performed procedure now.
And just to be clear, I mean, this isn't simply about controlling weight. The idea is also to mitigate issues that come with severe obesity over time.
Right. The terminology that we use now currently is metabolic and bariatric surgery. So these are really in many ways considered a metabolic operation, meaning that it really changes fundamentally how the body reacts to nutrition, makes insulin, and these are the things that drive most of the other health conditions that occur with severe obesity. And that's really our goal, is to improve the health of these patients, not just have them lose the weight. So that's exactly right.
And some of those health issues include what?
Diabetes. Actually, used to be that type 1 diabetes was called juvenile onset. Well, now type 2 diabetes, which is the one usually associated with obesity, is now more common in children than adolescent or juvenile onset diabetes. So that's becoming a huge problem. Sleep apnea is a big issue with kids and can really cause major heart issues later. Liver disease, orthopedic issues, psychologic issues, and cardiac issues. High blood pressure, we see teenagers with high blood pressure, with abnormal cholesterol. So really everything that you think of as an adult that you're trying to keep control of as you age are really problems that we're already seeing in these young teenagers, and they will continue to get worse if something's not done.
How often is this type of procedure, this type of surgery done with children and adolescents compared to adults?
Oh, it's far more commonly done in adults. It's hard to know exactly how many procedures are done in children, but we've been involved in some studies that estimate that it's probably somewhere in the 1,600 a year range throughout the country. In the adult world, that number is maybe 100,000. I'm not sure what exactly the adult number is at this point, but it's substantially higher. And if you kind of put that in the context of how many children and adolescents we believe in this country would be at least at the appropriate weight or BMI for this surgery, that's probably 4 to 4.5 million kids. So, you know, 1,600 a year is really not much.
I was going to say, why is that? I'll admit one of the things that I found just talking about this story in our newsroom was that the initial response is, Well, is that something they should be doing to kids? Is this a good idea for kids? Is that the primary reason why maybe this is not used as much in younger people?
Let me guess. The comment was like, is he crazy? Is that what it was?
It wasn't quite that strong, but it was kind of like a very surprised reaction.
Yeah. But I've gotten that before, to be honest with you. And that is one of the main issues, I think, is there's a thought that really this is just, you know, baby fat, if you will. And if you just wait long enough, it'll go away or, you know, they'll grow into it, that they really aren't sick and you're doing, you know, preventative surgeries. So those are a lot of the comments that we've gotten in the past when we've talked about this. And I've been involved in this for, you know, going on 15 years now. So I've heard it all. But I think, you know, more fundamentally, there's a bias in society that obesity is a choice. That's what we're trying to fight the most. I mean, it is a metabolic disease. It is partially genetically inherited. It's partially due to a lot of changes in our environment, the kinds of food we eat, the socioeconomic status of the families is very highly correlated with this. So it's not really just a lifestyle choice. And that's one of the big biases that we've been fighting. And quite honestly, they fought it in the adult world, too. But there are a couple of other reasons that very few procedures are done. First of all, if you look at the number of procedures are done, there aren't any places that are doing a lot of them. And so you've got several places just doing a couple. We probably are amongst the higher volume centers in the country doing them, and we don't do very many. And that's partly because there just aren't the resources available. So the requirements that we've put in the policy paper and that I've published in the past, you know, say that you really need to have a team of people who specialize in the care of children and adolescents with this problem. And there just aren't many of those, and they cost money. And then the final thing is, you know, currently many payers just won't pay for it because it's considered experimental, if you will. And so that was really one of the big drivers from my standpoint of wanting to come out with this policy statement, is to say, look, you know, these biases are not founded. We need to have quality centers that have the right resources, and we need to, as a society, decide we're going to treat this and pay for it.
So just building on that, why now for this policy statement? You talked about maybe some of the reasons why you wanted to say what you're saying and try to urge pediatricians and policymakers and insurers to improve access. Why is the timing right for this type of policy statement?
Well, I think it's the merging of some really kind of important different issues, and we've reached critical mass in a lot of ways. So the Academy of Pediatrics formed the obesity section only about 10 or so years ago, maybe 15. And so really up until recently, it hasn't really been looked upon as a huge problem, but the number of severely obese adolescents has doubled in the past 20 years, and it shows no signs of abating. So it is clearly becoming a major epidemic. In addition, there have been a couple of really well-designed prospective government-funded trials, one in the United States and one in Sweden, that have just published this year on their five-year outcome results on not only safety of the procedure and weight outcomes, but also outcomes in terms of disease reduction. So, you know, those came out this summer. The obesity section was formed 10 years ago. The initial goals for the obesity section were really to look at primary care and prevention, rightfully so. As the new leadership of the obesity section, you know, changed about 4 years ago, the new executive council was a group of pediatricians who were much more interested in this problem, the severe obesity. And so that's when we had the opportunity to partner with them. I would have never been able to do this if there was not a supportive group of pediatricians on the obesity section that supported it. So those are all things where timing just kind of came along properly. We've been working on this for 4 years. Mm-hmm. Honestly, we thought it was going to be out before this, but the Academy really takes a lot of thought, a lot of time to make sure that these policies address every issue and are really authoritative. Because once they come out, pediatricians really look to it as, you know, ways that they should be practicing medicine.
I do want to circle back to the process that individuals go through when they're considering this type of procedure. What are some of the factors that go into making that decision as to whether or not this is the right choice for a young person to go forward with this direction?
There are criteria, there are indications and contraindications. Probably the most important indication that has been clarified with this policy statement is that we no longer have specific age criteria. when we first started doing bariatric surgery in teenagers, we were ultra conservative. You know, we set an age cutoff of 13 or 14. You know, the weight at which they would minimally qualify for a procedure was far higher than it would be in adults. And that was set based not really on any empiric data, but just to, quote, seem safe. You know what I mean? So really that we've been battling that for the last 15 years because that's, you know, what everybody kind of grasped onto, particularly the payers, say, look, you know, this doesn't qualify according to your criteria. So we got rid of the age requirement now specifically. We don't have any data that doing this in younger individuals is detrimental. There are surgeons in other parts of the world who do them well under the age of 8 or 10. I think in this country it's probably not that common yet. But the other thing that was so important that really came out recently in these trials is that not only were they as effective as the procedures in adults, but what we found was that they were more effective at getting rid of the comorbid conditions than it was in adults. In other words, doing this procedure and dealing with the issues when you're younger makes it more likely that you're going to have a complete response. And even in the age groups between, say, 13 and 18, the longer you wait in that span, the likelihood of reducing that particular disease dropped by every year. So there's a lot of evidence that doing it earlier is going to be far better in terms of success rate. And finally, what we know is that no matter what operation you do, the maximum amount of weight a person is likely to lose is not more than a third to maybe 40% of their total weight. So if you weigh 300 pounds, you might lose 100 or 120 pounds, and that would get you where you need to get. If you wait till you're 400 pounds, you may never lose enough weight to become normal weight. So again, waiting till later, as people used to propose, we found on many levels is not the right approach to this.
Having said that, I'm curious, you know, what happens post-procedure to kind of build on the surgery and kind of keep an individual moving in the right direction?
The critical point is the surgery is just a small tool in a very large armamentarium, if you will. So at minimum in our program here at DuPont, our children are involved with at least a six-month run-up to surgery where they initially don't even meet the surgeon. They meet our pediatrician, they meet a nutritionist, they meet an exercise physiologist, they meet a psychologist. Everybody gets evaluated by a psychologist. We also have a social worker available. We have a nurse coordinator. So we have everybody that we need. And the first part of the program really is around helping them understand what needs to be done, working with the family. We have nutritional workbooks that they're required to complete, and they have to come regularly to appointments. And so once they've kind of gotten that pattern and they've really learned the correct nutritional tools and the correct lifestyle tools and dealt with any psychiatric comorbidities that there might be, then we begin to talk more seriously about the operation itself. The operation is, again, a fairly short period of time. It's a two-day hospitalization. But after they go home, they go back on a gradated diet. And at 7 weeks, we encourage them to get back to regular food. But they come here frequently to reinforce the nutrition, to reinforce the exercise, you know, to see a psychologist now and then if they need to. So the long-term follow-up and adherence to the guidelines is critical. Otherwise, you know, in the long haul, this is not going to be durable.
We've talked a lot about the data so far. I'm curious, what's your experience been personally with young people who have had this surgery?
So we have performed well over 150 bariatric procedures since we started. We started with the lap band in an FDA trial, and the lap band is not FDA approved, so we do not use that anymore. Since we've moved to the sleeve gastrectomy, and we've done between 80 and 90 of those at this point, the weight loss has been consistent and dramatic. Recognizing that not everybody comes in for follow-up for the long term, our most recent look at the data is that we have a 70% excess weight loss at 24 months, between 60 and 70%, which is, it hangs in there with the best of the data both in pediatrics and in adults. And we're finding a similar success rate at getting rid of diabetes, sleep apnea, liver problems, orthopedic problems, what have you. So our experience very much mirrors that of other centers in the world.
Finally, what impact do you hope this new policy statement will ultimately have on this procedure, this surgery, and those that need it?
great question. I mean, we really took some time to address this policy to three specific stakeholders, if you will. The first is the pediatricians who practice in the community, and they really depend on these policy statements to guide how they manage their patients. You know, think about all the vaccine policy statements and the policy statements on car seats. They're important things that have come out that pediatricians adhere to. We're trying to make it comfortable for them to make this decision and support not only, you know, referring their patients to places that can do these kinds of treatments, but really being part of the decision-making and part of the ongoing treatment plan. So that's the first group. The second group really is talking to payers. You know, there's no question that there are medical directors of insurance plans who, you know, who currently do not, for whatever reason, pay for this procedure. Most of them are policies that their company has made, and that's fair enough. But really, their concern all along has been the longer-term outcomes, the complication rates, and so now we have a good, you know, solid 5 years of data on that. That I'm hoping, once we get it in front of them, and that's the plan over the next couple of months, that it'll really change their approach to how they pay for this important service. And the third one is government agencies, right? CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, you know, Congress. I mean, we have to decide as a society that this is what we're going to do. We're going to take care of this segment, this growing segment of children who, you know, by the way, many of them are parts of ethnic and racial minorities. Many of them are socioeconomically disadvantaged. So this is really, you know, kind of an underserved, fragile part of society that needs all of our help. And so that's kind of the third piece of the statement. I don't know how much effect this is going to have on families and parents, but, you know, I'm thinking the more they know about this policy, the more they'll think about this as a possibility, too.
That was Dr. Kirk Reichert, Surgical Director at AI DuPont Hospital for Children's Bariatric Surgery Program. We thank him for his time on The Green this week. And next on The Green, Enlighten Me, and a look at changes coming to the Hotel DuPont's famed Green Room. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Changes are coming to the Hotel DuPont's iconic Green Room in Wilmington. After over 100 years of service, the restaurant's last day before undergoing significant renovation will be Wednesday, January 1st, 2020. The Buccini-Poland Group now owns the Hotel DuPont and is behind this reimagining of the Green Room. And for this week's Enlighten Me, Buccini-Poland Group co-founder and president Dave Poland joins Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele to discuss what the future holds for the restaurant.
Everybody has eaten, almost everybody, in the Green Room at some point at the Hotel DuPont. But there's going to be some changes coming up. Let's talk about it.
Well, the first thing I want to mention is we are so proud to be the stewards of this icon, you know, this really center of Wilmington culture, a place where families have celebrated milestones for generations. And our first mandate, don't screw it up. So we know that people are really going to be looking closely at what we do. And I want to mention that while the Green Room is still commercially viable, let's say, and it's providing a wonderful service and experience for people, you know, customers vote with their wallet. And they're telling us by their actions that the Green Room is not as relevant to them today as it has been in the past.
And why is that?
You know, I think there's really three kind of macro things that are changing. And I'll just mention briefly, the first one is, you know, the world has really changed. People dine out a lot more. Our generation, you know, whether it's millennials or boomers or Gen X, we're not as formal as maybe our parents' generations were. And a lot of us today are thinking about fitness, healthful dining, you know, eating more light. And so I think that that's number one. The second one is the hotel world has also changed. And, of course, the Green Room stands on its own, but it is part of the Hotel DuPont. And the people who come visit us, many of them stay at the hotel for the great food and beverage. And so their expectations have really changed. They're looking more for entertainment and experiential dining. They're looking for craft cocktails. They really want to get close to the local agriculture and farms and the bounty of that area. So that's another change. And then restaurants themselves have really changed. They know that we don't have an hour and a half for lunch, most of us anymore. We have less time for dining. We do want that authentic regional cuisine. So we feel like when we're visiting a place like Wilmington, we really can experience what's growing in the area and what season it is. So the dining has to really change. And then the final thing I'll mention on the changes that restaurants have undergone is that chefs have become superstars. And you see it on TV, and people really want to dine where a chef has curated a special menu, and it's something they can't get somewhere else.
Do you think you might be able to get Gordon Ramsay to come to the Green Room? No, I'm just kidding. He's just my personal favorite. I'm being silly here. All right, before we tell people, I should say, about what's coming up and what's going to be happening with the Green Room, take us back in history. How long has the Green Room at the Hotel DuPont been in existence?
Well, the current Green Room iteration started in 2004, so it's only been about 15 years that the Green Room has looked like it has. So going back to the hotel's founding in 1913, you know, the Green Room and the name has changed over the years as well. So when the hotel opened, it was just known as the dining room. So the Green Room moniker came in about 25 years after the hotel opened, and it was named after a personality, someone, you know, with the last name Green, who was close to the chairman of DuPont. What we would say, though, is that the hotel and the Green Room themselves have really evolved over the ages as people's needs and desires have changed. So we feel like this next evolution is really continuing to pull that thread of how do we be relevant to the city, the community of diners, the enthusiasts of the Green Room, and then the hotel guests.
Yeah, and over the years, there's been many award-winning cuisine come out of the Green Room, right?
Yeah, it's the only four-diamond dining establishment in the state of Delaware.
All right, let's tell people what's going to be happening as far as the Green Room hosting its last day of service on January 1st, 2020.
You bet. So we're really excited. After we announced that the Green Room was going to change, and we're going to close for a few months as we effect that change, we've created more opportunities for people to enjoy the Green Room, you know, one last time or, you know, over a series of dining events. And so whether it's Thanksgiving or Christmas Eve or Christmas Day or New Year's Eve, we've got more seatings available. And we're pulling out some great menus from past years, you know, things that have really intrigued diners, specialties, and those kinds of things. So when people are thinking about a special occasion coming up, or if they, you know, want to enjoy that Green Room and relive the memories of, you know, family time or hit tea with us, that'd be great too. But all that's available on the website, so people can choose the opportunity that's best for them.
All right, we're talking to Dave Polin. He's the co-founder and president of the Buccini Polin Group and also chairman of the PM Hotel Group. So what happens after the Green Room closes, Dave?
We're going to have an interim dining room set up in the Brandywine Room. And for those people who know the Hotel DuPont, this is a beautiful, rich, wood-paneled dining area. It used to be a restaurant, you know, back in the 50s and 60s. And we've added some really beautiful artwork, and we've upgraded the space. So it's going to feel just as delightful and elegant as the Green Room does today. We'll actually be using the Green Room furniture for that interim period. So from about January through April, the Green Room menu will still be available, and we'll still have a great dining experience for people. They'll still have that, you know, that regality, that formality to it, and great cuisine coming out of the same kitchen. The Green Room itself is going to undergo a really, let's say, a loving restoration. So you would never walk into that room with a sledgehammer. We'll be in there with tweezers and toothbrushes, you know, making sure that all that beautiful wood millwork and that hand-painted inlaid ceiling and, you know, the beautiful chandeliers are all renovated and upgraded and modernized. And then we're going to add in a lot of new finishes, and we're taking the restaurant in a new direction I think people will really find intriguing. We'll be talking a lot more about that in about 30 days when we can announce the culinary team we're working with, the name, and the culinary direction that we're going.
All right, so you're going to preserve the old stuff, and it's going to be closed. How long, I know you'll be announcing things, more exciting things about the new green room, as you said, in the next 30 days. But how long do you expect the work to take before the green room is reopened?
I'd say 90 to 120 days. And part of that time will be, again, pulling apart the existing elements of the room, restoring them, modernizing them, and putting them back. And of course, we're going to try to undo some of the things that were done over the years. For example, the carpet that's in there now, it wasn't laid over the beautiful tile that you see in the foyer. Unfortunately, much of that was removed and just a flat concrete floor was placed there. So we know we'll find some surprises along the way, and anything that we see that's historic and relevant, you will maintain and keep and celebrate. But our sense is that much of the original finishes, especially on the floor, are no longer there. I would definitely look for a lighter space, this big heavy window treatments from the 80s or the 90s and 2000s, that's going to go away. We really want to celebrate being on Rodney Square and 11th Street and being downtown and picking up that energy. We're going to be adding outdoor dining along Rodney Square, the newly renovated Rodney Square. So there'll be new awnings on the Market Street side of the hotel with new exterior access. We're going to add a new entry for the green room off 11th Street because many of us, when we dine in a restaurant, don't necessarily want to go through a hotel lobby. Of course, we'll still have valet parking available. We're just going to make it more accessible so you don't actually have to go through the hotel to get to the restaurant. So we're trying to think of all the thoughtful touches that people are looking for in dining today.
Do you think there are still people, though, Dave, that are going to be upset, disappointed that this iconic green room is no longer going to be the iconic green room? It's going to be different. A lot of people don't like change. I'm one of them. But what's the feedback you've been getting so far?
Graham, I'm really glad you mentioned that, because when we bought the hotel a couple of years ago now, we knew that we were, again, stewarding this icon for the next generation. And we moved very deliberately. We've assembled the Hotel DuPont Advisory Committee, and there's people who are, care deeply about the hotel and the committee. There's community leaders, business leaders, et cetera. And so we meet every quarter to talk about what we're doing, solicit feedback. And I got an earful. Matter of fact, when we talked about the next iteration of the green room, I there were some threats that I don't want to repeat on the air, but it's very meaningful to people. And so again, we don't screw it up. So we took several months to think about what should the lobby look like. DuPont had done a renovation, and they made it, I think, a little more modern, and it wasn't a space that really resonated with the community. So we made it more traditional, more comfortable seating, but we added communal tables, for example, in the lobby so people could collaborate or work together, or if they're alone and you want to do some people watching, it's a great place to kind of plug in and be in the center of things. So with the restaurant, we found out some of the things that I mentioned before about how people want to dine with us. They want to make sure they have a place to go with, let's say, 12 attorneys for a closing dinner, attorneys from all over the country. But they also want a place where they can go with their friend, girlfriend, boyfriend, and have like a more fun, lighter, more whimsical, romantic meal. And so we're incorporating all those different dining scenarios that are relevant to the community and to our guests, and coming out with what we think is a really terrific solution.
Dave, is it the green room that is known for the iconic macaroons?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Well, I, for one, will miss them, but will they be available in the other restaurant while the green room goes under these renovations?
Oh, my gosh, absolutely. Matter of fact, you may be aware that the Hotel DuPont Bake Shop, which, of course, services the green room and is widely featured there, has a line extension called Sparked in the Deco Food Hall. So macaroons are available there. They're going to be available in the interim dining facility that we have in the Brandywine Room. And then when we reopen, you can believe they're going to come back. Those are part of the fabric and culture of Wilmington, and we wouldn't even think about touching that.
All right. I will allow you to do these renovations, but you cannot take away the macaroons, okay?
You got it.
Hey, any final words that you want people to know about what's happening here?
Yeah, we're really excited about taking that green room experience that people have had and keeping the best parts of it. So this amazing backdrop, but we're adding things like seating outside. So when it's seasonal, they can enjoy a great meal outside. So we're not really taking anything away. If you want to have a multi-course real dining experience, you know, a more formal multi-course dinner, that is definitely going to be available. And we're going to encourage people to continue to celebrate their milestones and their family events with us. But we're adding, for example, a new bar. So it's a place where, again, if you're there by yourself or you're a hotel guest and you want to plug in, you can do that in the future as well. So what we're doing is we're adding, we don't think we're taking away any of the things that make the Green Room special. And we really want to thank the community and the city of Wilmington and the state of Delaware for being so enthusiastic to the changes that we've made so far. And we hope that that'll continue and we'll build more confidence in the community as we make finer touches to the hotel.
Thanks to the Puccini Poland Group's co-founder and president, Dave Poland, and R. Kelly Steele for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalina and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.